So we were covering chapter 3 Wednesday night, and when we got through the first section about time, there's everything has a purpose, everything has a time, a fitting time for it to occur, whether for those things we like and for those things we dislike, and established it's not times of our choosing, but according to God's timing. And we began on the limitations of man, and in verse, we covered man's tasks that he's been given by God, that his desire, in verse 11, to know, we have an awareness of eternity, that which has occurred in the past, and that which is to occur in the future, but we're not, it's not for us to know those things, but we have the desire to know those things. And that way we're limited. We're limited in what we can do. And we see also in 14 and 15 that God's, through His power, you know, nothing we do, through our power, we can't change anything that God has done. Of course, we can petition to God, and He might change His mind. But our power doesn't make Him change anything. So in all these things, man is limited. And we started covering some of these verses in, I don't know, the second dot of number 2. I wanted to go ahead and read, I guess, a couple more. Or I'll reread some of those. Just after looking at these limitations of man, how we're limited in knowledge, limited in power. In Job 40. All right. Yeah, that's right. Job 40, beginning in verse 6. This is when God answered Job after his questioning God. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God? Or can you thunder a voice like His? And then adorn yourself with splendor and majesty. And array yourself with glory and beauty. Disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together. Bind their faces in hidden darkness. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you." And of course, can man do any of these things? Is there... God's questioning, can you do these things? No, we can't. We are limited in power. This shows God's greatness. Also in Romans 11, 33. Romans 11, 33. "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments and His ways past finding out." Of course, again, we just, you know, we look at these scriptures, some of the ones that I didn't want to reread, and the last ones we do read, we see the grandeur and power of God, how He is not limited. And I guess we'll go ahead and read 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Paul's writing to the Corinthians in chapter 2, verse 6. "However, we speak wisdom among those who are mature, yet not the wisdom of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew, for had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory." See how. Yeah, "but as it is written, the eye has not seen, nor the ear heard, nor have entered in the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. But God has revealed to them, to us, through His Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of man except the Spirit of man which is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God." Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God. These things which we also speak, not in words which man wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. And of course this is talking about the revelation of Jesus and its purpose. But I had it in here just to look at, you know, sort of, you know, brings to light the difference between man's wisdom and God's wisdom. God has wisdom on another level than ours. It's not to be compared. So, we see these limitations. What moral purpose do they serve? That man is limited. Are we better?
To realize that we are, that we can't, you know, fight God, or we can't better Him.
Yes, that's right. We know our place, right? We know where God stands. What other reasons? I mean, what else, what attitude might that instill in us to have that realization?
Well, that we don't rely on ourselves.
Yeah, we don't rely on ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're talking about trust, right? Mm-hmm. We don't trust in what we can do, but we trust in God. And we see in Ecclesiastes, you know, where we're taking our reading from in verse 14. It says at the end of that verse, God does it that men should fear before Him. And that, you know, it ties in with it, with trust. We fear God. We know His power. We have that fear of Him, and therefore we rely on Him and trust in Him. And that's very important for us. You know, that's the attitude we should have. So, does anyone have any comments on that part? If we move back to verse 12 and 13, and how are we supposed to live our lives with concerning the timing of everything is outside of our control. Things occur. We don't like, dislike. We know God is powerful. We're limited. And how are we supposed to live our lives? How does Solomon recommend us to live?
Enjoy your life and be happy.
Yeah, enjoy your life
and
be
happy.
Yeah. We see in 13. All right. Yeah, that's right. In 13, every man should eat, drink, and enjoy the good of all his labor, for it is the gift of God. God in His power has given us this gift to enjoy it, and we should take advantage of it. But is that going to be something that's profitable? Does that answer the question in verse 3 of chapter 1? What profit does man have?
No.
It's recommended. It's, you know, something that's comparable. It's better than anything else we got, but it doesn't give us profit. We can enjoy it. We've already spoken. We read in chapter 2 of pleasure. We can have pleasure and it's nice, but it doesn't bring us any lasting profit. It's temporary and it's fleeting. And we see this also repeated in the end of chapter 3 in verse 22. It says, "For I perceive that nothing is better than a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage or his portion. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him?" And so we need, you know, it's recommended we should be happy. We should use what we've been given to make us happy. Any other further comments before we move on? Silence doesn't equal no.
Michael, I noticed your text back in 1 Corinthians that the comparison of the spiritual things versus, you know, the wisdom of man, the contrast is starting, and you see that when it happens in Ecclesiastes as well. It's gone. But you look past that, that's what the focus is in 1 Corinthians. Spiritual things versus earthly things. And I think that's yours, is that earthly, that's it. So that should point us towards God. You know, we talked earlier that there's eternal being we serve at, that He's eternal and can give us eternal.
Yeah. I mean, we're aware of that, you know, knowing that, I guess when we're studying this chapter, like you said, we get that in the context of everything under the sun, it's all vanity, it's all fleeting. And that, knowing that, being aware of that should lead us to seek God, to fear God, to trust Him. And of course, in the realization that there is more than just life under the sun. But for here at the moment, to prove that point, we're looking at just life under the sun. We come to these conclusions. And beginning in verse 16, we see this is a small portion of God's justice. In 16 and 17, "Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there's a time for every purpose and for every work." So we see wickedness in the place of judgment. We know wickedness is not supposed to be there. In the place of judgment, it should be justice. There should be righteousness. The fact that this is occurring, does that reduce, we're just talking about God's powers and how He's not limited, does this reduce the sovereignty or righteousness of God? The fact that this is allowed to happen?
No, He's the judge.
God's in control of everything. And when we find ourselves in difficult circumstances, I think sometimes we forget that God isn't the one that's in control. Sometimes we find ourselves in very, very bad situations through no fault of our own. But this is what God has ordained, and we have to get through it. We have to remember that.
Yeah, we know that God will ultimately bring, or will make a judgment. He says that here, whether it's talking about the final judgment, it's more likely talking about within our lives. He can bring to judgment people now, here, within their own lives for their wickedness. But, why do people sometimes think that this, may reduce the sovereignty of God? Why do we have that feeling?
Because we don't be justified now.
Exactly. We don't get the justice right now. We don't like to see it occurring to begin with. We don't like injustice. We want that to stop right now.
Sometimes when you think about Joseph, Joseph lived a long time within injustice. He was in difficult circumstances through no fault of his own, for living a good moral life, following God is the best that he could. But ultimately, he was rewarded on this earth.
Yes.
In addition to what he gets in the hereafter.
Correct. And this is all, most of this is within the context of time. We're reading in the end of verse 17, it says, "For there is a time for every purpose in God's judgment." There is a fitting time, and it will occur. It may not be fitting to us when it occurs, because we want it right now. But it will occur in its time. We know God's in control. I wanted to point out some of other God's judgments, just kind of... Sally had mentioned Joseph. And that's an example. I was looking through other examples of judgments of nations, and there's some interesting things here which would deal with the timing. In Genesis 15, beginning in verse 13 and 14, God's speaking to Abraham. Says, "Then he said to Abraham, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterwards they shall come out with great possessions." Of course, we know he's talking about Abram's descendants are going to be enslaved to Egypt. And that his descendants will serve them and afflict them. It says for 400 years that occurs. And we know that from the rest of the scriptures. And in Exodus, they will be taken out. And then that, Egypt will get judged because of that. But 400 years is a long, long time. But that's the timing of God, They oppressed, they afflicted, and they were judged. Just shows his power. Also at Genesis 15, that was close. 15 and 16. This one always I found interesting. In Genesis 15, verse 16, it says, "But in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." And so, talking about the descendants of Abraham will leave Egypt and go back to the land they're in Canaan. And also look at Exodus 23:23. For my angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. And so see, we see here, back in Abraham's time, 400 years previously, the Amorites were wicked, but their iniquity wasn't complete. And their judgment came 400 something years later when the Israelites came back and then cut them off. And so, I don't know, that always struck me, you know, that idea of their iniquity was not complete and that something had to come to pass and then their judgment, that, you know, so they were wicked before. We say, well, why didn't you just cut them off then? Well, we don't know why, but he did 400 years later. And I'll read the rest and I'll get to that point. We also see the judgment of the Jews in Habakkuk. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1 through 7. The burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out to you violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble, for plundering and violence are before me? There is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, therefore perverse judgment proceeds. Look among the nations and watch, or God's reply, look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told to you. For indeed I am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation, which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful, their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. And then over in verse 12 and 13, Habakkuk asks, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die, O Lord. You have appointed them for judgment, O Rock. You have marked them for correction. You are pure eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold their tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he? And of course, here in the beginning, Habakkuk is crying out about the perverseness of Israel, the wickedness in the judgment places in Israel. He's asking for it to be corrected. He wants justice. He wants God's judgment. And who does God bring to judge that Israel? Sorry? Yeah, the Babylonians. And what does it say about them? Yeah, they're wicked. God brings the wicked to correct the wicked. And Habakkuk doesn't like that much. He's like, what? They're the wicked ones. You should be judging them. You know, yeah, okay, I asked for judgment to us, but not with them, because they're worse than us. And it just shows, you know, God's judgment comes to pass, and we're not, you know, in our limited nature, we don't understand always why God does things the way he does. But we do see that he does bring about judgment in his time, and in his own methods, and they're not always pleasing to us. And in 2 Kings, I think that just shows the final judgment on Israel. 2 Kings 25. God said he's going to bring Babylon to bring this justice. And 25, verse 1. It says, now it came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the tenth month, in the tenth day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his armies came against Jerusalem, and they camped against it, and they built a siege wall around it. And then 9 and 10, he burned Nebuchadnezzar and his army. He burned the Lord, house of the Lord, and the king's house, all the houses of Jerusalem. That is, all the houses of the great he burned with fire, and all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls of Jerusalem all around. And so here we see that the judgment was forewarned, and here we see its completion, that God's judgment came to pass through the Chaldeans. And then also back in Habakkuk, Habakkuk in 6-7, we just read that, where it talks about we're not going to read it again, but we talk about how the wickedness of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, God uses them to bring judgment on Israel. But when you turn to Daniel 5, Daniel chapter 5, beginning verse 22 to 31, we see the judgment now comes on Babylon. read a bit. In beginning of verse 22, Daniel's talking to the king, "It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reached to the heavens, and your dominion to the end of the earth. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and its roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, and the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts of the field, till seven times pass over him." Here was the judgment on Nebuchadnezzar, that he became a beast. And this is pointed out. Wait a second. That's wrong. We'll get there eventually. I'm going to read from the wrong chapter. I thought that was funny. Okay, here. This is to the son of Nebuchadnezzar in 22. "But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this." And so that he knew all this. He knew how God had placed judgment on Nebuchadnezzar, how he went to the beast of the field, and then how he restored him to power. He knew all the things that occurred to Nebuchadnezzar by God's hand. He knew this, but still, in 23, "Have you lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven? They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, and iron, wood, and stone, that do not see or hear, and know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified." And then the inscription was written on the wall, and its translation was given by Daniel. "God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. You've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians." And so we see here that God used them to enforce justice on another nation, but their wickedness was brought about in time to judgment as well. And so God is in control. He brings about judgment in His time. Times aren't always pleasing to us, and we don't always understand why. Considering we want instant gratification, we want instant justice. We want justice at all times. But God doesn't those aren't His methods. And it brings to mind 2 Peter verse 3:9. I don't have to read it, but it's talking about, giving time to all men, that He doesn't want to see them destroyed, but giving them time to come to redemption. Maybe that's a reason that He gives time for these who are in wickedness. I don't know. It could be. It might not be. We can't search out God to except read what He's given us to read to understand. Rocky.
Michael, it's interesting as you look through all these examples here showing God's sovereignty, and He does things in His time, and decides when things happen. Another remarkable thing that's connected to all those that just blew my mind away is that God does all these things without violating the free moral agent of people. How does that happen? How can He bring a nation against another nation, but yet not violate their free moral agent? It just shows you the power of God and how He works. It's just beyond our comprehension.
Yes, it is. Does anyone else have any comments? I hope that makes sense.
I'm just kind of reciting a little bit, but one of the things strikes me on 16, getting back into the kind of focus of the book, you think about this from the standpoint of us, a man, a woman, whatever. In the context of this book, our life under the sun, we do all of these things, and yet there's no profit out of it. Not only that, we work. Work is things that are presented to us as we have riches, whatever it is we have, whatever our activities are. We bring about a change. At the end of the day, we're going to die, go to the grave, like everybody else, as far as life and the sun. But here's Solomon, as wise as he is, he looks around and he says, yeah, I do all these things, and yet here's this righteous, or the justice that ought to be, but it's not. So not only am I kind of frustrated because my own efforts don't play out the way I would like them to, I can't control my legacy in any such way anyway, but you're against me too, and this person's against me, in that where I should be getting justice, I'm getting evil, wickedness, but I can't do anything about it. Doesn't that? I can't change that. And so my life gets even less controllable under the sun. And yet, Solomon has an answer for us. Solomon's wise, and that is inspired. And we could get buried in woe is us. We talk about the book has a depressing side to it. Woe is us from all this bad around us. But Solomon gives a piece of advice. God will take care of it. Someday God will take care of it. Even if it's whenever it is. And we just need to go on and back up and do what he said.
We can't get too frustrated by our limitations. We want to see justice now. We want to control things, want things done in what we think is a proper time. But yeah, we just have to trust in God. Trust and fear in Him, and He'll take care of things. And beginning verse 18 through 22, the last section of this chapter, we go into a comparison of man versus beast. In 18 it said, "In my heart, concerning the conditions of the sons of men, God tests them that they may see that they themselves are like animals." Or, I think like may be added, so it could say, read that they themselves are animals. "But what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them, as one dies, so does the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that nothing is better than a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage." And so, we were remembering the context of under the sun. We know that man and animal are different entirely, but and under the sun, they are the same in a sense. And how is it that we are the same, similar to animals?
We all die.
Yeah, we all die. Man and animal both die. There's no advantage. It's all vanity. What other ways does it say that we are like an animal? It's pretty much the die, but you could look at it differently, I guess.
Returns to dust?
Yeah, we turn to dust. You know, we are made of the same thing the animals are. We're flesh and blood. We're made of dust, and we return to dust. Science fiction things there say we're carbon-based life forms. We're made of the same stuff. We're biological and chemical machines that God has made, and that laugh, it exists for a short time here on earth. Okay, that's later. Alright, so how do we differ from animals? If we're so much like animals, also, I wanted to point out, it talks about we have one breath. I don't know how you might take that, but we have only one breath, we only have one life, and once we die, that's it. It could be also just the fact that this idea of, I think, more of a fleeting nature. You have one breath. Breaths are short. They don't last long. And once you exhale, it's gone. So both die, and we're both very, very, very fleeting. Very temporary, like this. So how are we different? How do animals and man differ?
God gave us the spirit, a soul.
Oh, yeah. You said here.
I just took verse 21
Because it says, who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and that the breath of the beast ascends downward to the earth. And I took that to mean that man has a soul, while the beasts, they don't have souls, they just stay dust, whereas we have a choice of heaven. And I mean, I don't know if you can take it this far or not, y'all can correct me, but God breathed life into man, so.
Yeah.
I thought of it that way.
Listen, God gave us the ability, the reason to look towards heaven, to fathom what happens right where we know the things of God. The animal doesn't have that capability. You can see information, this is what we're built, but man has the ability to reach heaven. An animal does not. And in that sense, our breath is we can look towards heaven where now we cannot.
Is that what he's encouraging us to do here? Look toward heaven?
Yeah.
This one's hard. I mean, it doesn't necessarily say here that man is going upward and that beast goes downward. And I think the point to take is that it does, there is some differentiation, but it doesn't tell us what it is. I mean, like you said, David, that, here shows that man has a soul. Or, but what it says is man has a spirit. But it also says that the animal has a spirit, too. That we, so we might, I don't know if you could certainly say that with definity. I think it's just important to point out that there's a possible differentiation and that I'm not exactly able to clearly define what it's saying, because we're talking about life under the sun. It may not be talking about heaven or hell, the animal passes away and is gone forever.
You're kind of asking if you emphasize that, who knows? Maybe it's another way of looking at it.
Yeah.
At any point, can't men die? Animals die. What do you know about that? I mean, you can either look at it after they die, or you look at it as an objective observer, right? You have no control over it. Once again, they're dead. Rover, dead all over. Yeah, you don't know what happens. You know, one spirit goes this way, one spirit goes that way. You have no idea what the outcome is. And you come at the standpoint of, if it's yourself, you certainly don't know. When you die, I mean, that life under the sun's gone.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if it's dealing at all with, I mean, it doesn't strike me there's any context that says spirit goes to heaven, animal just.
Yeah, it depends how you read the question,
Staying within context.
Yeah, we're staying within the context. So, I mean, you can take it's just difficult.
Well, what about 12:7?
Yeah.
12:7.
Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and then the spirit will return to God who gave it.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a difference between the physical carbon copy us going to the earth and then the spirit going to God who gave it to us. And it may not say it in chapter 3, but it says it right here in chapter 12.
Yeah, but a lot of times when you see spirit, it's also breath. And it says in this breath will return to God who gave it. Who gave us life? Who gave us a breath? God did. And then it's taken back. So now your life is over. I don't know. I kind of go, I get lost.
Backtrack and say, maybe argue for itself a little bit. But even in verse 17, he says God will judge. Maybe Steve says the word judge. No, you can see this there. I'm going to take it. I immediately think, and you probably do too, I think a judge
is the end judge.
Is the court. The court's going to judge you. But the other possibility is he'll judge both. That is to say, what is the outcome of both? And he goes on and describes it right here in 18, 19, 20. Both will die. Don't worry about it. Both are going to die.
Yeah.
The fact that the wicked, while justice should be in Christ, that you found wickedness, the outcome of that behavior is going to be the same. They're not going to gain anything. It's going to be the same. They're going to die. Just like the righteous. And that's it's a, that kind of a judgment, not a judgment in the sense that they'll get their due rewards by going to hell.
Yeah. Or, like I think I mentioned that judgment, yeah, we are going to get death. I mean, it could be, God's going to give a judgment. It could be, like I said before, it's not necessarily the heaven-hell judgment, but God makes judgments on earth of the events that occur in our lives. You know, like nations, they come to pass, you know, they grow, and then they get judged and they're destroyed. It's difficult to read. But, so it depends, I guess, how you read it. It's like this verse, this question. Sometimes, you know, I look at it and it's like, yeah, who, like Mr. Osbeck said, who knows? In the context of this, man and beast, we both die. Does one go up and one go down? Who knows? We don't really know, because no one's come back to tell us. Of course, God has told us in other revealed scriptures. We know the truth, but that's where we learn the difficulty of staying on context. We're looking at life under the sun. We know more, but we can't always rely on that to interpret these scriptures. We have to keep that narrow view. Unless someone else has any more comments and explains it all to us. I want to move on and ask, you know, at the beginning of verse 18, it talks about how this is a test. God tests man. Or, you know, so how do we pass this test? How do we, what purpose is served in this realization of our likeness to beasts? What can be accomplished?
Be happy in our activities.
What?
Be enjoy life.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, that I think that's finally what we come to the conclusion to. But I think sort of our the attitude, I guess I should say, what attitude is? How does this best serve our attitude in life?
Well, still live a good life. Enjoy it, but live a good life.
Yeah.
Know that it's
going to
come to an end.
I know that it's going to come to an end. I want to turn back to Genesis in 2 verse 7.
Job?
Sorry?
Did you say Job?
Genesis. We have been going to Job a lot. Genesis 2:7. And it says, and the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. And we look in verse 19, the same chapter. It says, out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air, and brought them to Adam. And we see here, like, and we mentioned before, that we're both made of the same thing. We're both made of dust. God made us from dust. I think it's important to, it shows the idea of, you know, that we are both created by God. We, you know, we live on this earth, and we see the animals, and they're lower. We, you know, we feel ourselves more superior to them. We're above them. But that doesn't mean that we are the creator. The animals and man are both the created by God. And also shows this, the frail, fleeting nature of life. That's, I think that helps serve us to know we are, yeah, we all know we're created by God, but yeah, a lot of people forget. Like I said, they get this animal down here, I'm something better, I'm superior, or whatever. You know, we're both the created. In that sense, we're both equal. And we both die. We both have a temporary, a short life. Also in Psalms 39, some other scriptures that point out that same realization, that same awareness. In 39 verse 5, it is a psalm. Indeed, you have made my days as handbreadths, and my age is as nothing before you. Certainly every man is at his best state. Right, and certainly every man at his best state is but vapor. You know, we're very, very short compared to God. And also in 89, of chapter 89, Forty-seven through Remember how short my time is. For what futility have you created all the children of men? What man can live and not see death? Can he deliver his life from the power of the grave? And so, and again, we see this, you know, with this realization, we're the created, and that we're created for but just a short time, just a handful, and then the even in you know, God is forever, but even man, we've been around, mankind has been around thousands of years, and our life is but a little notch in there. It's tiny. You wouldn't even show up on a timeline anymore. And God is forever. There's even beyond that. I mean, we're nothing. And that purpose, I mean, can help us realize, as Priscilla said, that where we fit in the place and how we should, you know, treat how it goes. Oh, I lost the word. Oh, well. How we view God and how we should live our lives. And so we come to verse 22, and the same recommendation is made that Solomon's made previously. That nothing is better than a man should rejoice in his own works. And we saw that same conclusion in chapter 2, previously in verse 24, to eat, drink, and be merry. And earlier in this chapter, and again, we'll see it again in chapter 5, verse 18. And here's what I've seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor which he toils under the sun, all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage, and it is our portion.
Michael,
yeah.
Analogies have their weaknesses, so understand that. I don't know if this is a good analogy or not. But let's say that a father takes his son to the amusement park. His son will get 3 hours amusement park. Now that boy can decide, I'm going to enjoy this 3 hours, or he can spend 3 hours ranting and raving against dad, crying and moaning, why can't I be here 6 hours? And his whole time crying, or he can spend 3 hours saying, you know, these are nice rides, but I wonder how much better they could be, figuring, working, and trying to manipulate and see if he can get better rides, and without park, he can spend 3 hours just enjoying it. And it's up to him with how he spends his 3 hours. And if his dad is in control at the end of 3 hours, the boy may have ranted and raved or spent all his time working how to get better rides, but at the end of 3 hours, that's it. And that's the way life is under the sun.
Yeah.
So it's up to us what we do with our 3 hours.
Yeah, we have our slotted time, and we've got nothing better to do than to enjoy it.
You know, the boy might look at this other kid over here. He's a bad kid. I know him. He's in my neighborhood. He got 6 hours. Why don't I only get 3 hours? So he spends 3 hours in resentment and hatred, or he enjoys 3 hours.
I think that's a good summation of it. I was also about to ask a question to look at this recommendation. Based on Solomon's recommendation to enjoy life, to eat, drink, and be merry. And maybe Mr. Fano just answered it already. Why is that the case? Why is the case that we should enjoy life? And does anyone else have any other way to word it?
Can't come back. Yeah.
We can't come back. We you know, I think also I was going to make mention in verse 11. We saw that we desire to know more. We have this desire to know more, but we don't get to it, so we might as well enjoy it. And this kind of summation is good. But don't worry about the fact you keep getting more, you'll lose the opportunity you have.
Correct.
All right.